This is Build and Analyze, a weekly news and discussion show about the world of iPhone, iPad, iOS, and mobile web development. The show is hosted by Marco Arment, who's the creator of now so many things, Instapaper, the magazine, and more. And by me, I'm Dan Benjamin. Today is Friday, November 2nd, 2012. This is our 101st episode. I'd like to say thanks very much to our sponsors, Shutterstock.com, Lynda.com, and Shopify.com for making this show possible. We also would like to thank very much our brand new bandwidth sponsor for November, MindNode, an intuitive mind mapping app for Mac and iOS. Whether you're brainstorming for your next project, organizing your life, or planning your vacation, MindNode lets you collect, structure, and expand your ideas. Integrated iCloud sharing means you can always have your mind maps with you wherever you go. MindNode.com. Hey, Marco, what's the story with you up there? How are you all now?
I think we're okay.
All right. Because there was a question.
I'll be okay until after the show when I attempt to go get chicken salad, and I probably won't be able to.
Then things will really hit the fan.
I can't. No guarantees.
Well, so the story for the people who haven't been following along is that things you had, you went out to, where was it, Seattle?
Yes, that's right.
You went to Seattle, then you came back, then you had power, then you were without power. So late last night, you were saying, dude, I just lost power and maybe we can't do it. And then this morning came back on, so fingers crossed that it stays on for you. Sorry to hear the trouble you've been going through. That really sucks.
I mean, honestly, we really can't complain because most people who were affected at all by the storm were affected way worse than we were.
Really?
You know, we lucked out that there was really no damage to our house. You know, we still have, you know, all of our trees are still up and have most of their branches on them. So there was no flooding around here. So we lucked out in the grand scheme of things. And we have power now, even though, you know, it did go out, but now we have it again. Lots of people don't have power still. And that's like, I was driving around just restocking and running some errands the other day. And there were just, you know, there were so many trees down that, first of all, like, one block of every road is closed. So everyone has to drive around that block. So all the side streets are packed full of cars that are evading like the tree affected blocks. And there are so many power outages everywhere that even the traffic lights are out. So imagine, and there's no trains running. So imagine an area that's usually very, very healthily using mass transit, using no mass transit, having all of the roads be interrupted by detours and having no traffic lights. So it's the traffic is unbearable. It's very, very hard to get anywhere to do anything. Most of the stores and restaurants themselves are closed because they don't have power either. So it's very, very hard to really get anything done. You know, to even just to buy food is not easy. To run any kind of errand is really not easy. There's very long lines at gas stations, not because there's a gas shortage, but because there is a powered gas station shortage.
Oh, right. So they can't pump. Yeah, they can't pump without power. Right. So the ones that have the gas, it doesn't necessarily mean that they can pump it.
Right. So every gas station has a huge line of cars as if there were a gas shortage and there's like cops directing traffic in and out of them. It's nuts. And then if you don't have connectivity, like if you have no power or no phone or internet service at your house, which is true for a lot of people, then what do? You fall back to the cell phone, right? Well, as a result, the cell network is completely overloaded and completely useless. I mean, the cell network and some of their towers are down because they lost power too. So it's not a good place to be. But again, we lucked out because, you know, we at least didn't have any kind of flood damage up here.
A relief. That's the worst.
Yeah.
No water intrusion, no problems with your roof or anything.
No, we were lucky. There's a few houses in the area had trees fall on them. And even across the street, there's a big branch on our neighbor's house across the street, but I don't know how much damage it did. Probably not much. But we've had like very, very large old trees fall in the storm and fall onto people's houses and cars. So it's not a good situation. Anyway, I think we need to take advantage of this one chance, probably the only chance we will ever have, to directly preempt John Siracusa's show.
That's right. Normally our recording day is Monday, and because of your travel and then the storm, we are recording on Friday. And John Syracuse comes up in an hour or so. And now you've snuck in. And I think that I totally support your goal. And I'll go further and say, let's make it so that John has absolutely nothing to say.
That's awesome.
Okay. So whatever right, it takes, so let's do it.
We covered the storm. We have to cover the iPad mini's launch. And I mean, we haven't even talked since the event, have we?
No, we have not.
So the iPad mini's launch. I guess we could talk about the iPad 4 and Scott Forstall's exit.
Yeah.
And what other news has happened during... I honestly am asking you. Like, I want to cover everything we possibly can cover. What else has happened?
Well, I mean, Android has grabbed 75% of the market share for shipped devices.
So what are people doing with all these phones that aren't browsing the web then?
Well, we know now the breakdown of the browser breakdown for both mobile and regular platform. We can cover that.
Well, that's pretty cool.
Let's see what else we got with the Boxy TV thing. $99, you get 3 months free of a no limits cloud DVR service.
I don't know much about that. I only know what I think.
iOS 6.01 is available. The iOS beta 6.1 is available.
Well, the 6.1 beta. We can cover that briefly.
Yeah.
I looked at the API diffs and the documentation for it, and it looks like almost nothing has changed. I mean, I'm sure they're putting in bug fixes and stuff, but it seems like the major difference, I probably can't say. They've added a few APIs to a framework that changed a lot in iOS 6, but it's not going to be like a massive difference for anybody.
There's the one thing is they've, you know, it's subtle user interface enhancements, but of course people are talking about the possibility that with Forstall out, maybe we're going to see less of like the skeuomorphic design elements. Do you think that that's the case? I mean, we can talk about the whole Forstall thing, but what's your take on that?
Well, from what we know from the inside workings of Apple, what we know as a combination of what's been said and what's been rumored and everything, it seems like one of the major drivers of skeuomorphism was Steve Jobs.
Right.
So a lot of people speculated that once he was gone from the company, not from the world, but you know, obviously right. That happened soon afterwards. Once he was no longer at the company, that maybe that would then make them shift more towards modern, clean, quote, designs and away from skeuomorphism. And that didn't really happen. We also know that Forstall and Steve were very close and were very much on the same page with a lot of things. So it is very possible that once Steve was no longer at the company, that Forstall kind of took over that crusade.
Yeah.
But we don't know that really.
We don't. Well, yeah, there's no way to know that for sure. Yeah.
Right. Now it does seem like Forstall's exit probably had nothing to do with that. I think the people who are more familiar with the executives like Gruber and Jim Dalrymple, who've been writing about this, I think they really have hit the nail on the head, which is basically saying, like, you know, Forstall's forced exit from the company has nothing to do with skeuomorphism and everything to do with how divisive he was in the executive team. I mean, it seems like there have been many, many accounts of many of the higher-ups really not liking him, having a lot of friction working with him. Some of the biggest ones that have been cited have been Johnny Ive and Bob Mansfield, which are, you know, two very important people in the company. And I'm sure there are many more. You know, it seems like he was just divisive. And, you know, if it comes down to the potential to lose somebody like Johnny Ive, who is very valuable to that company, versus Scott Forstall, we don't really know how important Forstall is to the company. Like, from the outside, it's really hard to tell, like, what he was doing that was particularly unique. We don't really know. You know, we know he was leading iOS, but, you know, how much of iOS's success was thanks to him, and how much of it was more of a group effort, and, you know, how much, like, what are we losing by losing him? And we on the outside really can't tell. So I think it's easy for us to look at this and say, you know, we think this isn't that bad. Because it seems like, you know, iOS is great somehow, whether it's his fault or not. But it would have been more disastrous to lose other high-up executive talent as a result of his continued employment.
Right.
So it seems like, you know, Tim Cook made the call that, okay, this guy's being very divisive, causing a lot of friction. Of all the possible people we could lose from this, it's easiest to get rid of him than to potentially lose one or two or more other very important people. So it seemed like that's what really was really going on here. I don't think it had anything to do with interface design at all. I think the interface design changes that might happen, if Forestall was really the remaining one holding on to skeuomorphism and fake leather and stuff, I think we might see a change now as a side effect of his departure, but I don't think it had anything to do with it. All right, you want to talk about the iPad mini a little bit?
A little bit.
Yeah.
How do you want to take this? I mean, we can talk about Reuters reporting the shorter lines, or do you want to just talk about the... Now, do you have one of these? You don't have one yet.
It is on vehicle for delivery.
as is mine, and now considering that your situation with the one-lane roads and things like that, what do you feel the chances are of you getting it today? You still betting you'll get it today?
I'm betting... I would say there's like a 60% chance that I'll have it today. And I'm guessing it will come at like 5 p.m. I was hoping it would come before the show, but that was very optimistic.
Yeah, me too. And mine is on FedEx vehicle for delivery. I'm having it sent to the UPS store around the corner so they can sign for it and I can go get it, after doing the shows. I don't have to worry about missing it.
FedEx will deliver to a UPS store?
You would think it'd be like crossing the streams, but in reality, right. Yes, they will do that.
Wow, that's crazy talk. All right, so I really think, I wrote a blog post to this effect, but I really do think that the iPad mini is going to be the iPad line that we're all using within about 2 years. I think up front, a lot of us are going to use one and switch immediately. It's going to work very similarly to the MacBook Air. A lot of people are going to switch to it immediately. But I should point out too, I made the comparison of the MacBook Air, but the first version of the MacBook Air, while it was very compelling in a lot of ways, also had severe drawbacks. And it mainly speed was very slow. The available disk sizes were very slow, and it was very expensive relative to any other computer or any competitive computer. Now, the iPad mini really has very few of those disadvantages. The iPad mini has major advantages in size and weight. It is way smaller, lighter. This is not a small difference. This is a big, big difference in size and weight. And so I don't know yet, but I suspect and all the reviews so far confirm that it really is going to feel great in your hand. And so that's a major advantage. It's also just like a little more practical. Like it's probably going to run cooler than the big iPads. That's my guess. It will charge much faster because it has a much smaller battery. People are even saying that it's shipping with the iPhone size.
Right, the iPhone size.
AC adapter.
Yeah, the little tiny one. And I've seen pictures of it shipping with that. And I'm assuming that, sometimes exactly. Like we see that like in the UK or other countries, they will get a larger rather than a smaller charger for like iPhones and things. So that's kind of interesting to me. Looking forward to getting more reports about
that.
So
it's going to charge with the smaller plug, which probably means it's going to charge faster, but also because it only has like a 17, I think, 1 hour battery.
Yeah.
Something like that. I looked at the iFixit teardown. That's where it was like it's like 16 or 17 versus the full size iPad's like 45. Like it's a big difference in battery capacity. Simple little things like that all add up. It's going to charge faster. It's probably going to run really cool because it's using the Dyshrunk A5. It's going to, you can use your iPhone charger and it'll charge at quote full speed. Like all those little conveniences all add up. And then there's the big conveniences of the size and weight. Obviously the lower cost is going to be a factor for a lot of people. And then, the downsides are pretty much only that it doesn't have an A6, which is a very minor thing because the A5 is pretty good. The only major downside, I think, is the lack of Retina. And that's going to cause a lot of people in our circles to reject this thing. But I honestly think that's going to be not as big of a deal as most of us think. And I think a lot of us are going to be willing to overlook that to get all those other conveniences. So we'll see what happens. For the time being, I really think I'm going to love this thing, but this will all be out of date in, 6 hours when I actually have one and I can give a more definite opinion. So let's move on before we before we miss all of John Syracuse's opportunities.
Right.
We could talk about Windows 8 and the RT launch. Thanks, yeah. Trev Cole from the chat.
We need to do that. That was on my list here because you had a nice piece on that over on Marco.org, which is a brand new blog that you've started.
I've definitely not been running it for 12 years.
Oh, you know what Syracuse is definitely going to talk about is a Lucasfilm thing in the Star Wars movies. So we've got
I don't have that much to say on that because I'm not really that into all this stuff.
It doesn't matter. We still got to talk about it.
That's true. We should talk about it.
So
okay.
we'll do that. And hang on, an alternate universe. So before we do that, let's you know what we should do? A quick sponsor.
Quick sponsor. Let's do it.
Let me go to that right here. Shutterstock.com. Over 20 million stock photos, vectors, illustrations, video clips. If you want images for your website or your blog or your print ad or your trade show or whatever you do, even your app, Shutterstock.com is the way to go. They add 10,000 new images every day. They work with freelance photographers and illustrators and designers and people all over the world. You download an image. You get it in any size. You only pay once. They don't nickel and dime you. You like the images? You take them. You get them. You get them full size. Same thing for all their videos. They even have an iPad app that helps you do it. You can manage your own light boxes, create your own packages. And if you use the code DanSentMe11, because this is the month of 11, you will get 30% off any package once you find the stuff you like and you want to buy. Shutterstock.com, Dan sent me 11, 30% off. Thanks very much to them for making it possible. On October 26, Marco posted something called an alternate universe.
Alternate.
I thought I was going to read it like alternative. An alternative universe. And you went to the new Microsoft store. I also went to the new Microsoft store around the same time, and we had a very similar experience. The main thing is the guy who you had, who cornered you and gave you the spiel, you said he was not very good and it seemed very rehearsed. The guy that cornered us and gave us his spiel was very good, even though it was still sort of like corporate speak stuff. He was very good. He was very good, and I would give him a B plus.
I spoke with two different salesmen. The second one was, you know, just firing on all cylinders, constantly had a response to everything I said. Even when it didn't make sense, he at least had a response. Most of the responses did make sense. One thing I didn't mention in the article, I don't want to rehash the whole thing, but one thing I didn't mention is that I kept trying to pick up the Surface and detach the keyboard cover and use it without the keyboard cover.
Right.
Every single time, both salesmen kind of railroaded me back into trying it with the keyboard cover again. And I kept saying, oh, I want to feel it without it. And one guy was like, why would you ever use it without it? Why would you ever not have the key? Because I said, like, you know, what if I want to travel light and just bring the Surface and leave the keyboard at home? And like that blew his mind. He was like, why would you want to do that? There was no reason for me to have to want to do that, according to this guy. Like, why would you ever do that? And I think that's interesting. It's worth pointing out, like, as part of, and of course, all the services that were on display had the touch keyboards attached. They really are seeing it this way as a thing that you prop up somewhere and use on a table, on a Surface. you know, they really don't, and which is funny because they really are pushing the whole laptop angle, but this is the first laptop that you can't use on your lap. You know, you need it to be on a flat surface to prop it up with the kickstand and to lay that keyboard out. Otherwise, you have to detach the keyboard and put it somewhere. I don't think it folds back around like the smart cover half-assed does. You know, I wonder, do we know what the Mini, has anybody reported yet with the iPad Mini? When you flip the cover back around, does it stick better to the back? Do we know that?
Anyone in the, if we may have some international listeners in the chat room, the Jackal. So if you're in there, let us know. It's a good
question.
Anybody
in New Zealand got theirs early? Well, because New Zealand's like living in the future.
Yeah, they are.
Those guys are cool. Oh, the accent is funny. You got to admit. so anyway, Surface, I don't have that much more to say about it because I really didn't spend that much time with it. It seemed very much like a PC. And they've made a lot of good strides. There were a lot of things about it that were impressive. But overall, it feels like a Windows PC with this layer on top. And, you know, Windows has a whole lot of just, you know, little rough edges. And so does the Surface, and so does what we can't call Metro anymore. But right. I'm going.
I still call it Metro.
There are just so many of those little things that aren't right with it, that are a little bit rough, and there's so much good there. But in the end, you're still using a Windows PC, and you can still really tell. And so I think if you're not at all interested in using a Windows PC, you probably won't be interested in the Surface either. Meanwhile, if you like Windows PCs, if you are already in the Windows ecosystem, if you use a PC already, this thing's going to feel great. It's going to be, you know, it's going to have a similar relationship as, you know, the way Mac people like iPads, like this kind of companion device to your big device or to your big computer. To some people, it can be their only computer. Certainly not the RT model, I don't think, but the once the Pro version comes out that has all the fan holes and runs the actual Intel CPU and has no battery life, please email Dan. Mm-hmm. Once that comes out, that could probably be your only computer for Windows people. But you know, this device just overall, you know, it really wants you to be in the Microsoft ecosystem. It's all about, you know, their cloud services and all that stuff. It's all integrated. Very similar to like I never had a great time using any Android devices, partially because I'm not that much in the Google ecosystem. I don't use Gmail. I don't use Google Calendar or their address book or anything like that. I'm not really in that ecosystem. And so it was hard for me to get into that. Similar with Microsoft. It's talking about, you know, your Sky Cloud Drive and all this stuff. And I can't wrap my head around that because I'm not in that ecosystem. And so I can't really use that. I can't really take advantage of that. So if you're really invested in Microsoft, this probably makes a lot of sense. But for people like us who are Mac heads who are looking possibly as a curiosity or an experimentation device, I don't think it's suitable for that at all. I just think it's a lot more PC-like than I expected.
No, I agree with you, especially, you know, and I think you, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you went into this a little bit, how when you launch the Office apps, how you are sort of dropping down into what is essentially the Windows desktop with the taskbar and start menu and
there's no start menu.
Right. There is no start menu, but there's that bar across the bottom.
There is the taskbar.
And it just seems, I think so. And there's like a desktop background picture. And it seems like why have I done this? I've now, you know, it's like, which one is really underneath the other? And to a consumer, again, you know, like guys like us, yeah, we know what that means. We know what's going on. But to a consumer who is maybe tried an iPad or even, I mean, look, like this Nexus 7, you never leave the what feels like the operating system and go to another operating system. And that was a little bit weird, a little bit jarring. And then when you're within those apps, you're dealing with regular traditional Windows dialog boxes where mm-hmm. you have to tap on the screen to then type inside of a little dialog box because it doesn't automatically put the cursor there. And you've got
and very small touch targets, too.
Very small.
It's a very rough experience trying to use Office on there with as a touchscreen app. Again, they really want you to use those keyboard covers. The keyboard covers both have little trackpad areas, so like they have mouse cursors that you can use. So really, the messaging is, you should be using this most of the time on a table with the keyboard. That's really the strong emphasis right here, that you are not going to get, quote, work done with this thing detached in the air. You're going to put it down somewhere and use it like a laptop. And that's why I think if that's really what you're going for here with this thing, why not just get a really small laptop? Like whatever the PC ripoff equivalent of the 11-inch MacBook Air is, just get that. Like it seems like the times that you will use this thing as a tablet, you might be better served with a real tablet. Oh God, yeah. Please email Dan. I don't know. It felt very rough whenever it dropped into that mode. Certainly, the performance was terrible. Like Office for ARM is not fast. Even like simple things. Like I tried to resize the window, which was not only very frustrating because it wouldn't recognize my touch until I hit the exact right pixel. But then the performance was awful, like dragging that window. It just, so much of it feels rough. That's what I'm saying. Like if you really want the smallest Windows PC that you can carry around, then this is a great choice.
Right.
But again, it is a Windows PC and it does not let you forget that.
That's a great way to say it. It really doesn't let you forget it. And it you know, I will say that, like, the colored tile panel Metro style interface, that's really cool. Like, I really like that. I like the idea of getting the updates there, of the things that you use, being able to organize it. The, you know, one of the things that I noticed, and the guys were at the store, who they don't leave you alone. They're right. No. They're right there with you, like, every step of the way, multiple people. And, you know, there are a lot of gestures, and over the, you know, we've discussed this many times, are gestures good or bad? If you know about gestures and you know how to use them, and WebOS is a really good example of gestures that I just loved on the Palm Pre Plus that I had, you know, like, to multitask, you would sort of swipe up or, you know, from the bottom, you'd swipe up, and then it would switch to this little card view, and you could swipe left and right to switch between your apps. Really cool way to do it. If you didn't know about that gesture, and of course you can read the book, but who reads the book? Then you would never know how to switch apps. You would never know. Well, you could say that double tapping the home key is effectively a gesture that you wouldn't automatically know about. So I don't know. Like, I go back and forth on this, but so many things on the Surface relied on gestures. To get to application specific settings, you had to swipe up from the bottom. How would you know that? Well, you're shown that. Right. Okay. Well, swiping from the right, bring, you know, so there were all different kinds of gestures that once you learned them, it made using the Surface easier and better. But there were things that were absolutely hidden that if you didn't know the gesture, you could never get to them. You know, if you don't know about double tapping the home button on an iOS device, well, you can just find the app that you want and tap it again, and it will launch it, and it's back where you were. That's maybe not as great as some of the other ways to switch applications, but you can still get there. Whereas, how would you get to application settings on the Surface? I'm sure there's a way. I'm just saying it wasn't as intuitive of an experience, and it did feel a little disjointed.
Right. It's also, you know, very similar to Android's interface paradigms for like hiding settings in those little pop-up menus. It much of what you see, you're right, like, it's like you can't tell if there even are more settings to look at without doing a gesture or hitting a button. So you kind of find yourself like poking every screen, like, oh, let me check that the menu button, or the, you know, let me swipe in that menu from the right or the bottom to see, oh, you know, how, you know, is there something more I can do here? And on iOS, there is no universally recognized thing like that. Right. There's no button for that. So on iOS, the general paradigm is to just have visible on-screen buttons for anything you can access. Like, have some visible on-screen way to get to anything that is there. And that is less, quote, clean visually. But I think functionally it works a lot better. It's a lot like, you know, last week we talked about, I mentioned how I tried to design the magazine with no setting screen. And in practice, that one design decision caused me to have to make other bad design decisions that I now have to revert, and I now have to add a setting screen.
Right.
I think Microsoft's, you know, everything's always full screen, but there's also no controls being displayed most of the time. I think that is one of those decisions where it is a good design decision in some way, but then that design decision causes them to have to make other bad design decisions to work around that, or to keep that, to keep that established, to keep that aesthetic. So it just, I didn't get the feeling with Metro that, or whatever it's called, I didn't get the feeling that in practice I wanted to use this thing more. You know, it just felt like a PC with all of Microsoft's usual lack of finesse and kind of, you know, brute force applied technology. Like, there are some good ideas there, but there are also a lot of rough edges. And I would not say that the Metro design universally is a good design, because functionally it doesn't work as well as you think it does. You know, I think anybody who's really curious to try this should go, you know, if you have a Microsoft store near you, go try it. Go play with one. I strongly encourage that. It is interesting. It is an interesting device. It's worth playing with, but I don't think it's the kind of thing that people like us should buy to have one, you know, to play around with, or, you know, to live with that for a month as our main tablet. I don't think that's going to work out.
Do you think,
especially for $600?
Well, true. Cost is a big factor for this. Do you think that Windows, like, people who are, and we have a lot of Windows listeners, I think, to this show.
Oh, I'm sure.
Do you think that this device is going to appeal to them a heck of a lot more because they're in the Windows world already? And for them, this is like, hey, this is, quote unquote, the laptop I've been looking for kind of thing. Like, for do you think this is more, I'm a Windows user and this is a great Windows device for me and I'm going to get it? Like, well, I think that, I actually think that's a big part of their demographic. Hopefully it is.
I think for the time being, though, I think Windows users might be very disappointed by the lack of apps, and on the RT/ARM version, you know, they can't just sub in their own apps on the desktop. So I think transitionally, people who are very heavily invested in Windows, who want this to be more than just like a, like the way most of us use our iPads is kind of this side device, this accessory device, not our primary computer. Not even our laptop in most cases. Most of us, like our Mac heads, most of us don't use iPads as laptop replacements. We use them as this kind of this additional, you know, media type device. You can use the Surface RT for that if you're a Windows, if you like Windows and you like that kind of stuff. You can use it for that. That's fine. I don't think it could replace anyone's laptop because there aren't enough apps compiled for ARM.
Right.
And so with the RT version, you can't use the Windows desktop for anything but Microsoft Office and whatever Microsoft blesses, because the RT version can only use apps from the Windows store, or their apps, whatever they call in the App Store. It can only use those apps plus Office. So they can't just put all their old apps in the desktop and switch over to that mode. They have to use the Intel tablet for that, which isn't out yet. That's the one that has all the fan slots all over the whole perimeter. And that's not out yet. And I don't even know if we even have a release date on that yet. I don't know, whatever. It's not out yet.
Yeah.
So I think Windows people who are looking to maybe replace a laptop with this should probably wait until that one comes out. And even just to see if it will be better. But also to give Windows apps more time to make Metro style, Windows Store style versions so that they can run an ARM. Right now, it'd be a very limited app market, and that's not what Windows people want to hear. It's not what anybody wants to hear.
Right.
All right, let's move on. I don't really have anything to say about the iPad 4. It seems like a very minor update. I think anybody who's really angry about it coming out so soon shouldn't be too angry, because there's not much different about it. It really, they changed the CPU, and I think they made one of the cameras a little bit better, the front camera, right? And that's pretty much it. They really didn't change that much about, oh, and lightning connector, but who cares? They didn't change that much about that device. So I really would not worry too much about the iPad 4 if you're an iPad 3 owner.
Right.
There's just not that much to say about it. I am curious if it ends up running cooler, because the iPad 3, while it doesn't run hot, like Consumer Reports said, it does run warm. And it's mildly uncomfortable, you know, after a while to be holding this warm thing if you're like me and you often have sweaty hands. That's uncomfortable.
Right.
But you know, it's not like, you know, burning or anything. I also just think it's inelegant. I think in many ways the iPad 3 was an inelegant product. You know, in order to get the Retina screen, it had to get bigger and heavier and have this gigantic battery that took forever to charge and had this massive CPU that made a lot of heat. All that stuff is not great. I'm hoping the iPad 4 fixes a lot of those things. It didn't fix the size or the weight, but I'm hoping maybe it'll at least fix the, you know, the power. It ships with a bigger AC brick. It's, I think it's 12 watts instead of 10. So it should charge a little bit faster, and hopefully it runs cooler. But it's still a big, heavy, chunky device. And one of the main reasons why I think a lot of us will be willing to overlook the iPad mini's lack of Retina, because obviously Retina comes with a major cost here. And by foregoing Retina, at least with current technology, with this generation, by foregoing Retina, the iPad mini is able to exist and have lots of positive gains over the iPad 3/4. All right. Lucasfilm and Disney. Got to keep plowing through Syracuse's time.
Yeah, we got to bust through it. Let's do our second sponsor then.
Yep, let's do it.
Lynda.com, brand new sponsor. Hope you guys like these folks. I really do. Because I like screencasts. It's an online learning company. They've got more than 77,000 video tutorials that teach you software, creative, and business skills. You can learn anytime, anywhere, even at your own pace. You save and prioritize courses in your queue. Whenever you're ready to watch them, you watch them. Let you track your progress. It's very cool. You can learn on the go with their optimized mobile site. They've got a free iPhone app. They've got an iPad app for members. They've got it all. Little tiny tutorials, comprehensive courses, everything from web design, programming, photography, business, audio, video, 3D animation, you name it. They're adding courses every single week, and they're really, really high quality stuff. Their library keeps pace with the stuff that goes on. You read about it on the web, you want to learn how to do it, they'll teach you. Membership starts at $25 a month. You get unlimited 24/7 access to top quality videos taught by experts with real world experience. You want to try them free for 7 days? Go to lynda.com/5x5, and it's LYNDA, lynda.com/5x5. Thanks very much to them for making this show possible. Check them out, support the show. Lynda.
So I wrote a very quick thing about Lucasfilm and Disney, basically quoting that horrible PR statement.
Yeah.
they can't wait to have the global lines of business take control of this global franchise and extract as much value out of it as possible.
Right.
I got a few emails about that already. Basically, people are saying that shouldn't be too much cause for concern, that apparently they don't even have, Disney will not have the rights to the 6 already made Star Wars films for, I think, 10 more years. I mean, like, Fox will retain rights to those for a little while longer, at least. So they won't be able to really mess with the old films further, I think, based on what this means.
Right.
What it sounds more like is that they're going to have not only the rights to make new films based on all these characters and everything. So, and they said they're already planning Star Wars Episode 7. And so who knows how that will go.
Right.
So not only will they have the rights to make new additional Star Wars films, but they will also have the merchandising rights. And that's major in the Star Wars world to have. I mean, they do so many marketing tie-ins, many toys.
It's crazy.
And like theme park rides and all sorts of crap. And that's not new. You know, George Lucas has been marketing Star Wars relentlessly since the original Star Wars came out. So, you know, that's not going to be necessarily a whole new thing. They just might be doing more of it. So we'll see. It does seem like the whole reason they're making the new Star Wars movie is probably so they can sell more Star Wars toys and do even more of that marketing and licensing and promotional
right.
crap.
Right.
They might even make more from that. I don't know for sure, but something tells me that they might make more from the merchandising at this point than they do from the movies. But who knows? I could be way off on that. Oh, I don't really have much more to say about that. Do you?
Well, I mean, do you think that this is a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, what is your Star Wars movie? Which one do you connect with the most?
I mean, I don't like any of the prequels.
Yeah.
But for the regular series, I don't really care between them. Like I know geeks usually love Empire the most.
Right.
And it's kind of cliche to say you like Jedi the best. I don't really care. I saw them when I was a very little kid when they came out, but I don't really remember much from that. Like, I mainly saw them when they did the restored versions, which I know everybody hates, in the late 90s. That's when I sat down and watched all three of them again with an older head, you know? So that's when I got more into them. And I mean, I was in high school by then, and or at least middle school, I forget. But yeah, so, you know, I kind of saw all three of the old ones together for the most part. So I don't really distinguish between them much. I like all three of them. I can tell all three of them have benefits, but yeah. But I think Star Wars now is kind of like Weezer now. Like, Weezer put out two fantastic albums and then an okay album. And then a whole bunch of really terrible albums. And now, whatever Weezer releases now, I'm mostly going to ignore, because they had they lost me as a fan so long ago from their series of crap that they put out. And I feel like Star Wars might be the same way for a lot of people. It probably is, at least that way for me. That, yeah, Star Wars was great back in the day. And then they had a really terrible period. And we don't really have any reason to believe that they're out of that terrible period entirely, or that this next film won't continue that terrible period.
Right. Right.
So I feel like, you know, if it's really terrible, well, like what if Weezer releases a new really terrible album? Who cares? Nothing's different. They were already releasing terrible albums. If they release a good album, we can be pleasantly surprised. Same deal with Star Wars. I think if Episode 7 turns out to be really cheesy and crappy and mostly just to sell toys, just like Episodes 1, 2, and 3 were, who cares? Another crappy Star Wars movie. You know, that's not new. It's just continued sadness, but it's not new, really. If they release a decent or even a great Episode 7, that's a different story. Then now that's positive. But, you know, I don't really feel like, first of all, I don't think that's extremely likely to happen. But, you know, if it turns out being mediocre or crappy, we're not really that disappointed because it's what we expected. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
All right. I want to talk briefly about New York data centers.
New York data centers such as Pier 1.
Yes.
Not to be confused with the store Pier 1.
No, this has two E's and it's all capitals, I think.
And the one is the number right next to it. No space.
Yes, exactly.
And this thing is the data center where folks like Fogbugs and Squarespace and a lot of other folks were. And it has received a whole bunch of media attention because, like many, many places in New York, it flooded, at least the basement and the ground floor, flooded with the Hurricane Sandy that came through. And most, if not all of their, I guess, like, were they the generators that would run, that would provide power, like the fuel lines and things like that, were down there. So when that flooded, they couldn't get fuel to the generators, which should be running to keep everything powered. So they were well set for most kinds of electrical problems. If they went off the grid, if power was down for even extended periods of time, they would have been able to run no problem. But this is kind of the one situation where they wouldn't if there's water down there.
Yeah, I mean, and this happens not that infrequently to big data centers. I remember one of the big ones that I noticed was back in Hurricane Katrina days, something awful had hosted themselves on a data center in New Orleans because their sysadmin had lived there and wanted to be able to, it was colo, so he wanted to be able to directly service the servers, which is fairly convenient and important for sysadmins to have to do in colo situations. And it's just for people who don't know, when you buy hosting, you can either buy virtualized stuff, which is running on other people's servers, or you can buy dedicated servers, which you pay, you know, a few hundred bucks a month generally. You pay per month to lease a server that somebody else manages physically for you. Or you can do co-location, which is you actually buy the servers up front. You own the physical servers. You pay someone's data center to let you install them in their data center and use their power and internet connection. But you own the servers. You manage the hardware usually, you know, except for, you know, you can occasionally have them do trivial things like hard drive replacements for you. But generally, you manage the servers yourself in person. And so usually the reason to have co-location in areas that could be affected by natural disasters is because you're close by, your business is there or your sysadmin is there. And so when something has to be done physically to one of the servers, your sysadmin, you can just drive there and do it directly.
Right.
And there's other reasons to choose these locations. Like in the case of Manhattan, it makes sense maybe for latency reasons, like if you're doing high frequency trading or something, who knows. But for the most part, people who hosted their stuff in Manhattan were doing it because they owned the servers, they were co-locating them there, and they needed access physically to administer them periodically. Because otherwise, if you're doing like a dedicated server, like a leased server somewhere else, you just want it to be somewhere that's going to be reliable and safe and relatively fast. So a very popular destination for those is Texas, because Texas is centrally located in the United States. Generally, you get roughly equal pings to both coasts. It has lots of data centers because most of it is relatively inland, doesn't really get affected too badly by natural disasters, and it has very cheap electricity and very plentiful electricity. So
all you have to do is dig like 2-3 feet down and there's oil or coal or whatever. It's right there.
Yeah, exactly. You can plug the wheel right into your Opteron.
Yeah, and they give you the free guns. So sometimes people will just shoot into the ground and the oil is right there.
Of course, yeah. Isn't that how most of the wells are discovered?
Yeah, it's time saving. Yeah. That's how Jed found it.
Exactly. So, you know, I've never done colo. All of my server experiences have been dedicated servers. So I've only ever dealt with remote data centers with servers that I didn't have to buy or build, and servers that I don't have to physically administer, that I have to create a ticket and some awful, awful web interface for somebody to go replace a hard drive for me when they die.
Right.
I don't know what it is about hosts and these ticketing systems. They are always the worst interfaces. They're so not just ugly, but frustratingly unusable. Really, it drives me crazy how bad these things are. But that's a side note. I think if you look at something like our frequent sponsor Squarespace, they've been affected heavily by this because their main data center, I believe, is in New York, right? Is that's like their main or their only location, right?
I think.
Do we know that?
Yeah, I think it is.
So, you know, they've been going through a lot of trouble right now because, again, like data centers use a ton of electricity for one thing, and they are basically, you know, they try to have lots of redundancy built in. They have backup generators. They usually have, at least the good ones, they all have multiple internet connections from multiple places, multiple providers, and multiple physical directions. So they try to accommodate for any disaster that might happen. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as we saw with the tsunami in Japan, like and the nuclear problem they had, disasters are disastrous. You can't always plan for every possible outcome. And there are some things that are just out of your control. So in the case of a data center, if you run out of power for a very long time, you are beholden on two things. You need those internet connections to stay up that you have. You need at least one of them to stay up.
Right.
And you need a constant supply of diesel to power your generators. Because no matter how, you know, you're not going to have enough on site. Even if you have a big tank waiting around you, it's not going to power you for very long. If the power is going to be out for like a week, you know, you're going down. Simple as that. Unless you get more diesel. So that's been the main problem they've had, is first that they had flooding on the bottom floor, as much of Manhattan did. And so that knocked out a lot of the pumps and a lot of the backup equipment, as you said. And I think some of the generators themselves, I'm not sure about that, but you know, it was like multiple failures. It was, they lost power and the basement flooded. And so a lot of times fault tolerant systems, like they can take one failure, but usually not two or three, you know, usually something has to stay up for them to keep working. And so there's really nothing they could have done. And now their problem is they can't get diesel fast enough in a lot of cases. I don't know currently, I've had pretty intermittent connectivity myself, so I'm not familiar with the current status of it. Doesn't really matter. It's a podcast. Most of you aren't listening live. But I know they've had a lot of trouble getting diesel in fast enough. And then, and they're still beholden on their upstream providers. So like if they're connecting to some peering point to some other internet connection that's in another place in the city or in New Jersey, and that goes down, well, they're screwed. Like that just, there's nothing they can do about it. So, you know, the internet is this very interdependent, interconnected system. So if all the things that you're depending on, if your connections fail, then, you know, even if you can power yourself, you're down. Or if you run out of diesel fuel, if you can't get trucks and barrels in there fast enough, and you can't get people to carry these barrels upstairs fast enough and pour them into the generators fast enough, then there's just nothing you can do about it. So a lot of people have criticized, you know, they've been like, why would anybody host something in New York in these data centers? I don't think that's necessarily something we should be asking too hard. Like, usually there's a really good reason for it. Whether you're building custom hardware, or you need, you know, tight control over your hardware, or if you just have so much hardware.
I mean, this is something
it's worth it.
Yeah, I mean, you make a really good point in that people are always under the impression, oh, well, you know, like I got a virtual server, or I'm going to go with company X in Texas because that's, you know, the nice data. Well, it is not old fashioned to have a data center be close to where you office. And officing in New York for a lot of people makes a lot of sense. And being able to say, yeah, we have 50 servers or 500 servers or whatever. This is such a freak scenario that, and other people have said, oh, well, these guys should have all had like redundant data centers elsewhere. Well, yeah, if you're like a, you know, multi-million, multi-billion dollar company, yeah, you have multiple data centers in multiple locations and you have staff to manage them and you have data syncing up back and forth and, you know, but failover for the operation of companies this size, it is obviously a priority, but it's big, big, big money that maybe some of these companies don't have. And then you have the attitude of, well, then you shouldn't have expanded too fast. You should only expand up to your capacity. I mean, there's going to be an argument for all of this stuff. What I'm saying is, like, don't fault these people for not having like multiple redundant data centers across in every city of every country of the world. You know, like that might just not be practical for many reasons.
If you look at things like every time S3 fails or one of the Amazon Web Services fails, usually it's EC2 actually, but anytime there's a right. big Amazon Web Service failure, they almost always will publish some kind of postmortem and will tell you, you know, here's what happened. Here's why it failed. You know, this thing had this failure and then the system that we made to detect that somehow failed usually. And that's why it propagated and made a bigger problem. You know, usually that's the kind of thing that happens. And if you look, like, Amazon's web services are very well deployed, very redundant, very fail-safe, but they still fail. The fact is, as I've talked about before with you know, the myth of free scaling, these things are very complex systems. They're never going to be flawless. Any kind of massive multi-server, especially multi-data center kind of system, has so many dependencies on so many little moving parts, some of which are out of their control, some of which have never been seen before. So like some of these conditions have just never happened. Like, you know, every programmer, I'm guilty of this myself, every programmer has had some kind of bug or failure in their code and somebody tells them about the condition that led to that and you're like, I never considered that, or I've never seen that before.
Right.
You know, this happens to all of us. Imagine that with these massive scale systems of trying to host very, very complex websites on multiple servers, multiple virtual instances of servers running through all these networking equipment. There's so much that can go wrong. So many possible scenarios that you probably didn't think of. You know, I think this stuff will always fail. There will always be imperfect hosting. And the thing is, occasional downtime, like, okay, here's the thing. If Squarespace goes down for a day or two in the wake of a huge natural disaster,
right,
in which so much damage has happened to various cities and towns here.
$60 billion, isn't that what they were saying? $60 billion anticipated damage?
Right. There's been so much damage here. So many things happened that have never happened before. You know, like so many thresholds were passed, so many records were broken. You know, there are so many things that never happened before. And the fact is, who cares if a few websites are down for a day or two? For the most part, most websites don't need to be up. Like, most websites aren't that important that their disappearance from the internet for a couple of days is going to be disastrous to people. And if that is the case, they probably didn't host themselves on a third-party hosting service. You know, so I feel like of all the things that have gone wrong here, who cares really if something like this is down for a day? You know, they should take reasonable precautions to avoid it, but they shouldn't like quadruple their hosting costs to do that, because most of the time it doesn't matter. So it's always a balance when you're doing service providing here. It's there's always a balance of cost and complexity versus uptime. And it's like, how many nines? You're up like 99.999% of the time. Well, that's three nines or five, depending on how you count them. And okay, well, if you want to go 99.9999% uptime, what do you have to do? What, you know, what has to change? What has to be made redundant? How many different backups and failovers do you need to achieve that extra level of uptime? And when you look at these numbers, like, you end up having to spend way more money. It's probably exponential. You end up spending way more money to get each one of those additional nines to have, you know, to go from an hour a year of downtime down to 15 minutes a year, or down to 5 minutes a year, or down to 40 seconds a year.
And you know what? I mean, to their credit, the Squarespace guys who, I mean, you know, disclosure, they're like a sponsor of ours and they have been for a while, but they had a really cool, I'll put this in the show notes, 5by5.tv/buildanalyze/101. If you want to check these links out, they have this all on their status page. Like they anticipated some serious downtime, and they had like people going up and down 17 flights of stairs with fuel to like run their generators. Yeah, I don't like
carrying 55 gallon drums. Yeah. Of diesel.
I mean, you know, look, maybe they should have had a second redundant. I don't think they should have. I think they probably until the next epic Frankenstorm, but like seriously, what these guys have done to keep the service up and running is really impressive. And I don't think they've had any downtime. Like my sites haven't gone down on Squarespace. So, I mean,
that's great. And look at the hoops they're jumping through to do that.
Exactly. You know? I mean, and you know what? Like they're doing what it takes and they're reacting to it. And they have like pumps pumping fuel to different generators that they've installed on the roof and pumping it back. I mean, like it's crazy what they're doing. But you know, someone say, well, they better do that. Well, they are doing it. And it's, you know, they're figuring it out. And that's what companies have to do. The best companies, like, they say, oh crap, what are we going to do? And they figure something out.
Exactly. But, and also I should point out too, I know we're running,
into John Syracuse's close time to the now, edge. So
we will end it in a minute, but, one time downtime in the grand scheme of things does not matter. Nobody will remember it after next month. Like even if they went down for 3 days, it would hurt them. Now, some people would move off their service now. Some people would be very angry. But next month, nobody would remember. It would be gone. Frequent downtime is a problem. You know, if you're down very frequently, people will remember that. It will affect you for a long time. Think about the reputation Twitter used to have. That took them years to get rid of constantly fail whaling and having lots of scaling problems because they were down frequently for like a year. So that was a problem. But if you go down once, like there was one time in like 2007 or 2008, back when Flickr was still a very majorly used and very important service, there was a time when Flickr was down for an entire weekend. And do you remember that?
I do remember that. That was a big deal, very big deal back then.
Okay, well, you're supposed to say no, you didn't remember. Most people...
Well, I do because I know people that work there. That's okay. But it was it was a big deal for them who worked there.
Still, that was a major site that was down for like 3 days.
I don't remember that, Marco. I can't recall this at all.
And the fact is that hurt them for those 3 days.
Right.
And then like a week later, nobody mentioned it again. And it was just, okay, well, now we're back using Flickr again. Like they didn't lose a whole bunch of users because of that. Like they didn't have this reputation of being unreliable from that point forward. A one-time problem isn't that bad. You know, and that wasn't even because of a natural disaster. That was because of a bug. And it's still not that big of a problem, you know? So I don't think anybody can really fault people for having local data centers. And, you know, there's so many reasons to do it that, yeah, it's inconvenient when a hurricane hits, you know, once every 3 years or longer, hopefully. But anyway, that's that. Now to end this on a political note,
of course,
everyone loves when we talk politics.
Yes.
I do think it's ridiculous anybody is still denying climate change, because it seems like every single year, literally every year for like the last, I don't know how many years, every year we have a new once in a lifetime storm. Like we got new gutters and new dry wells installed in our yard as part of the construction last year. And one of the terms that they kept using was we have to account for a 100-year storm. I'm pretty sure in the last 3 years, we've had two of those. The idea is that this is a storm that happens every 100 years statistically. And we keep having them. And every year we get a new superstorm or a new crazy something, a new massive hurricane, a new crazy weather event that supposedly has never happened before or happens every 100 years. Those are happening every year now. So I think it's ridiculous that anybody's still denying that stuff's messed up. So, all right. I think we're done. Let's let John Siracusa go.
Let's let him go. You can go to 5x5.
We'll let him find the one topic that we didn't cover.
But he'll just have to, he's right now, he's saying, I'll just cover them again. 5x5.tv/buildanalyze/101. That is where you go for the show notes. If you'd like to read more from Marco, you can go to marco.org. You can follow him on Twitter, Marco Arment, A-R-M-E-N-T. He is just Marco on alpha.app.net. He does this Instapaper thing, got the magazine. So go check him out. I'm Dan Benjamin on Twitter, Dan on Alpha. And of course, 5x5 has lots of other shows you should go check out, like The Frequency, which is our new daily news show. You can check that out and a whole bunch of other great shows. And Marco, have a wonderful day, and hopefully your power will continue.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
You too.